Eleanor Marx is a significant name in the socialist movement for two reasons. One should be fairly obvious to people, and that is her family name. She was the third and the youngest daughter of Karl Marx. But the second reason, and what I'll be focusing on today, is that she was regarded by her contemporaries as one of the greatest women leaders of her time. Will Thorne, who was the leader of the Gas Workers Union, which Eleanor Marx went on to sit on the executive over a whole period of years, even though she wasn't a gas worker herself, her involvement in the struggles of the new unionist movement inserted her in a very important place in Labour, in British Labour history. And Will Thorne describes her like this. He said, "Eleanor Marx could have been a greater woman leader than the greatest of women leaders of her time." And what a time it was as well. And this is part of the point of the talk, and I hope something people will glean from it, is the significance of this period in British Labour history that saw the rebirth of socialist organisations in Britain, that saw an explosion of militancy amongst the unskilled and previously unorganised sections of the working class in Britain. And Eleanor both witnessed the founding of the Independent Labour Party, but also herself was an organiser of the founding of the Second International, and also a very important and significant event in the socialist movement. But before I talk about her political career, I do actually want to start with the first reason for her fame. I do want to give people a bit of a sense of her background and of her early life, because her later life bears the indelible imprint of being a member and growing up in the Marx household, and all of the rich, both cultural but also political experiences that brought with it. I mean, you can imagine the sorts of dinner table conversations that she was privy to when you had the leaders of the socialist and the labour movement around the world traipsing through the Marx household. First of all, Eleanor was very close to her father. She saw herself as, I think that's why, later in her life, she saw herself as being the torchbearer of his ideas. That meant both doing the very nitty-gritty work of helping Engels to collate her father's papers after his death, and really, she's part of the reason that we have works like the second and third volume of Capital, with, Eleanor worked, on those sorts of things. She also, though, played an enormous role in popularising the ideas of her father, from in small branches of socialists to in front of crowds of hundreds of thousands at demonstrations that she was involved with. And the identification with her father actually went both ways, but Marx said of his daughters, he said, "Jenny," his second daughter, he said, "Jenny is me," sorry, "Jenny is like me, but Tussie," which was the affectionate name that her family and her intimate friends gave her. He said, "Tussie is me." So there's a very close connection there. Second of all, the two most important political questions in front of Eleanor as she grew up was, first of all, the question of Irish independence, and Eleanor attended many demonstrations in support of the Irish, and later in her life this would be a theme that she returned to again and again. She both went over to Dublin and organised amongst Irish workers, gas workers once again, but also often lectured British workers about the importance of supporting their Irish counterparts as well. And the second thing that had an enormous impact on her, and indeed the entire socialist movement, was of course the Paris Commune. That Eleanor actually became engaged to one of the leaders of the Paris Commune, Lizarra Gray. The engagement was broken off, and I don't think Marx much approved of it for that matter. But she later then translated his very famous work, The History of the Paris Commune. And again, every anniversary she was asked to lecture, apparently asked to speak, her speeches only increased in their brilliance. And, that you can read in the book that I very much recommend to you, the biography of Eleanor Marx. You can read about the absolute accolades that her contemporaries gave her. As the commune, speaking about the commune was one of her first public speaking engagements. Later in life, as an occupation, she became a typist. She did not leave behind her the economic privations, I guess, of the Marx household. There's a real misconception that Marx was this sort of middle-class person who enjoyed this privileged life. He was very, very poor throughout his whole life, and Eleanor herself worked throughout the majority of her life. She took up the occupation of being a typist, which actually gave her a real appreciation for the plight of outworkers or sweated workers, because working in the home is, of course, working in one of the most unregulated workplaces of very unregulated work practices at this time generally. And finally, in terms of giving you a brief biographical sketch of Eleanor, her most significant relationship was with Edward Aveling. Aveling was himself a leader in socialist circles and was a part of the New Unionist movement himself, got elected onto numerous executives of the New Unions. And they were political collaborators, but he seemed to have made her personal life very unhappy, and there's much speculation about the role that he played in her very, very tragic end. Eleanor suicided at the age of 43 in 1898, and the socialist movement suffered an enormous loss through her ends. But, of course, this is not her legacy. Her legacy is a rich political career that spanned over, as I said, one of the most important parts of British Labour history, and that's what I'd like to turn to talk to you about now. I want to begin with her involvement in the emergence of the new socialist organisations. Two sort of quasi-socialist organisations emerged at the same time, the Democratic Foundation and the Fabians in 1881. And Engels talks about the significance of their emergence at this time, and he says we have to understand it, you have to look at what's going on in British capitalism at this time. And that's a very important methodological point, actually, that the class struggle is something that is a two-sided affair. If it was just one side, well, it wouldn't be much of a battle. But so we can't just look at what is happening on our side amongst the workers, we also have to look at what is going on amongst the ruling class at the time. How capable are they of ruling, of imposing their agenda on society as well? And at this time, the British ruling class is going through something of a malaise caused by, you know, this is several years into the Great Depression, but also the rise of capitalism internationally had seen the rise of the manufacturing industries throughout the rest of Europe be able to compete with Britain, and so their British monopoly on manufacturing begins to break down and fracture at this point. This leads to more and more instability, but it also leads to the introduction of mass productive methods that draws in thousands, hundreds of thousands of unskilled workers into manufacturing, and these workers will become the base of the new unionist movement, and that's important for later on. Now, the Democratic Foundation changes its name in 1884 to the Social Democratic Foundation, and it's at this point that it takes up a more openly socialist program that Eleanor and Aveling, for that matter, join and very quickly become elected onto its executive. It brings together hundreds of radicals of this time, names that may be familiar to you, people like William Morris, Belford Bax, John Mann, even Oscar Wilde was a fellow traveller of the SDF for a short while. But its leader, a man by the name of Hyndman, would be a political character whose outlook would be familiar to people in this room. He was a barrister and a company director, and he started his political career by standing as an independent, actually, but in reality more of a Tory. He wasn't elected, and he turned to the socialist movement. Now, his revulsion at the crimes of capitalism seems to have been genuine enough. However, he also had a profound contempt for the victims of capitalism as well. He wrote to Wilhelm Leibniz in 1897, this is after witnessing the emergence of the new unions, he was able to write Our working men are so ignorant and depressed by hundreds of years of capitalist tyranny that it is hard to rouse them. Every year that passes brings on more educated lads to take the place of the old, hopeless workers. And it was this political outlook that dominated the SDF that led them in a profoundly sectarian direction that made them absolutely unable to relate to the new unionist movement. The fact that they could draft in 1890, you know, in the midst of this time, a 9-point program that made no reference to trade unions whatsoever indicates what planet these people are on. And in fact, Hyndman wrote of the docker strike a turning point, an absolute turning point in, at this time, that it was a waste of energy because it took socialists out of the active propagation of socialist ideas. Yet, the organisation at this point actually splits not over this question, but over the question of chauvinism. Apart from being an anti-Semite, Hyndman also agitated for British workers to be suspicious and wary of foreigners. And so the split, which Eleanor and Aveling are a part of, is about reasserting the international interests of the working class and reasserting Marx's concluding lines of the Communist Manifesto that workers of the world should unite as opposed to look suspiciously over one another's shoulders. In this new organisation, the Socialist League, Eleanor develops as a public speaker, lecturing on topics as diverse as what would socialism be like to the poetry of Shelley. It grows, the organisation, this is by participating in the free speech movement and the what are at this point almost daily demonstrations of the unemployed. Because remember, we're going through the period of the Depression here. However, the organisation does not fare much better, unfortunately, than its predecessors when it comes to the political questions that it confronts. And the organisation begins to be polarised around the question of what attitude socialists should take to Parliament. At this point, there is no Labour Party, remember. There is no Workers' Party. And workers, politically, are organised in the radical clubs, which is affiliated or aligned with the Liberal Party. Again, I feel like Sherry now, having to explain that, you know, the Liberal Party was the open party of the bourgeoisie, but was, you know, not as conservative as the Conservative Party, so, you know, to give people a sense of it. So workers and trade unionists would meet in these radical clubs all around London, you know, and were organising and talking about political issues and really were aligned to the Liberals through lack of a working class alternative. Eleanor begins to, and she's all the time drawn throughout her political career to working amongst where workers are organising. And so she's drawn into lecturing in the radical clubs, and she makes an argument and a serious push for unity amongst the socialist organisations with the radical clubs. And she comes very close to doing that. However, the Socialist League will have none of it ultimately. Ultimately, William Morris, who himself is more and more influenced by anarchist ideas, argues instead that socialists running for Parliament would dirty the hands, would sully the efforts of socialists. And this political outlook, this need to build a pure socialist movement, leads the organisation towards rejecting just immediate demands of the trade union movement, and ultimately they reject the demand that unites hundreds of thousands, if not, if you look around the world, millions of workers around the 8-hour day demand. They reject this. It's like if we turned up to the trade union, the work choices demonstrations with a banner that said abolition of wage slavery and nothing less. You know, it wouldn't exactly be that successful, I suspect. So Eleanor distances herself from the Socialist League as well, although she continues to work in different ways with each of the organisations. I want to say something briefly now about her attitude to socialist organisation before I move on to the new unionist movement. First of all, she did see organising as socialists as important. In their statement when they left the Social Democratic Foundation, they wrote, "We do not wish to work as individuals." They saw themselves as more effective as organising together. This is also borne out by her tireless efforts to organise the Second International. She played a very practical role here in translating the invitations that went out, but also and also the replies. But Engels also entrusted her with the task of trying to involve the union leaders as well, because they, in organising the International, they faced a problem not uncommon to the left, in that there were two international conferences organised at the same time in the same city. There was Paris in July of 1889, and her role was to try to involve figures like Tom Mann, like Will Thorne, in organising the one conference to be more effective. Second of all, she was for the independent organising of the working class. She saw it as a profoundly important step, the founding of the Independent Labour Party, because, you know, workers being able to vote for people who were ostensibly supposed to represent the interests of the working class was just a basic way of basic class identification. And thirdly, she thought that socialist organisations must, to be worth their while, must orient to working class struggles. And the Social Democratic Foundation and the Socialist League, just to sum up, I think, you know, that sum up their errors, really fell into the same sort of trap as the reformists cultivate, and that is that they separated off the goal of socialism from the means of getting there. The reformists separate these things off by concentrating on the struggle for immediate reforms, while shelving the ultimate goal of socialism for some time in the distant future. Well, these sects flipped this on its head. Instead, they argued that they would only focus on the goal of socialism with no reference whatsoever to the class struggle. However, Eleanor had the approach that Marx and Engels had tried to pioneer, that actually the goal of socialism would be born out of the struggles of the working class themselves. And it's now that I want to turn to the new unionist movement. The new unionist movement was born in the East End of London. Now, the East End was the industrial sector of London, and the population really exploded. It doubled as the industry was rapidly developed at this time. But that meant a couple of things. For one thing, it meant that sanitation was incredibly, incredibly poor. And the second thing was that workers lived amongst the pollution caused by, every new chemical that was discovered was inserted into industry in some way. And with that, new and horrible deaths and diseases came with it as well. And so, the East End, it's like people are living amongst these terrible stenches, diseases, not to mention the starvation of the caused by the Great Depression. Eleanor, just a few months before really the explosion, takes to wandering through the East End, and she comes to know it very, very, very well. And it has a profound impact on her. She says, just looking for my page reference. She writes to her sister of the terrible starvation that she sees all around her. She says, "Of the misery here in London, I do not think even you can form a faint conception. To walk through the streets is heart-rending. I know the East End well, and I know the people who have lived here for years. Thousands who can usually just keep going at any rate, during the first months of this winter, this year, are starving." Unlike her contemporaries who formed a fairly contemptuous view of these people, Eleanor was enormously compassionate, but she never wrote off their capacity to draw a line in the sand. And indeed, that line would be drawn by workers who had no record of strikes, no record of trade union organising. They were 13 to 15 years old. they were Irish. Now, the Irish were considered the lowest of the low. They were shunted into the worst possible occupations, and they were young women. The first of these strikes was amongst the match girls at the Bryant May factory. And I was actually driving through Richmond just the other day, and you can see the Bryant May factory. And it was also one of the biggest employers of women in Melbourne at the turn of the century as well. These women were striking over the fine system, so, you know, the already very, very meagre wages eaten up by these arbitrary fines imposed on them, you know, the sort of conditions that, you know, we're all familiar with, this sort of early period of industrialisation in Britain. But the significant thing is that they won. They notched up a victory. And this, you know, was the prelude to the whole new unionist movement. But the real turning point, the real turning point comes with the Dockers' strike in 1889. Again, the Dockers, people use excuses all the time for this particular group we could never organise amongst them. Well, the Dockers are the archetypal example of this. There were hundreds of docks around Britain at the time, and that meant hundreds of different employers. Sometimes in the one wharf there would be several different employers as well. And the way that you were employed was that you turned up outside the gates every morning and suffered the humiliation and insecurity of not knowing whether you would be employed for that day for, you know, like a tiny, tiny, you know, couple of cents really per hour. Engels, you know, describes the situation of the dockers like this. It'll be worth the wait, don't worry. Okay. He says, they are, as you know, the most miserable of all the miserables of the East End, the broken down ones of all trades, the lowest strata just above the lumpen proletariat. These poor, famished, broken down creatures who bodily fight amongst each other every morning for admission to work should organise for resistance, turn out 40 to 50,000 strong, draw after them into the strike, all and every trade of the East End in any way concerned with shipping, hold out above a week and terrify the wealthy and powerful dock companies. That is a revival that I am proud to have lived to see. And what he doesn't say, but that Eleanor points out, is that they actually had to build wooden palings along the fences because they found that the crush was so terrible in the mornings that people were impaling themselves on the fence when they were made of metal. Yet the dockers, within 3 days of going out on strike, there's 10,000 of them, their movement, they would all ultimately involve 100,000 dock workers, but also, as Engels points out, almost the entire East End turned out for demonstration after demonstration of support, and in doing so, they built up an enormous unity despite the way the bosses had pitted them against each other, and inspired an enormous level of solidarity that would go on to inspire huge sections, vastly different sections of workers into struggle. Not to mention the fact that their victory was enormously significant. Eleanor threw herself into this strike. She didn't have too much to do with the match girls, but in this, she went down to the demonstrations on a daily basis, and she involved her, you know, she spoke, and she was noted for speaking particularly to women workers and talking about the women who were the wives of the dock workers. And she gets a real following at this time. But the leaders of the strike, people like Ben Tillett and Tom Mann, pay real homage to Eleanor's role. To give you, you know, some sense of the quite central role that she played. Will Thorne, again, says that Eleanor Marx acted as a correspondent for the committee. She worked very long hours, and she walked bravely late at night or early in the morning, then back to her distant home. Sacrifices unnoticed and numberless were made. But all distinction was lost on this great and inspiring phase of the class struggle. So she was, you know, a very important part of it, and indeed went on to organise amongst particularly, you know, women workers, as the title of the talk suggests. She organised strikes amongst jam jar makers, amongst sweet makers, onion peelers. She was part of a strike by 10,000 Jewish tailors as well. And it's at this point that she both declares herself Jewish, she learns Yiddish to be able to better relate to the Jewish workers, and once again we see that it's amongst, you know, a section of workers that people had dismissed as being, you know, having their own communal traditions, they weren't interested in trade union organising. Well, they, start to organise amongst themselves and actually then start to want to organise not just as amongst their own communities, but amongst the working class as a whole. And but probably her most significant work is amongst gas workers. And, you know, as I said at the beginning, she gets elected to the executive of the gas workers union, despite not being a gas worker herself. And her nickname was Our Mother, according to Engels, because she was so much loved as part of this movement. And it's actually the gas workers that are the first to go on strike for the 8-hour day, and that is how their union was built. That Will Thorne, you know, as a contrast to union leaders today, Will Thorne worked from the age of 10. He worked 12, 14-hour days. One of the things that Eleanor did was actually have to teach him to read and write so that he could fulfil his role as secretary of the union. He and a few others organised to go out on strike for the 8-hour day. They organised 3,000 first of all, and then very quickly their union, 3,000 joined the union on the spot, and then very quickly it grows to some 20,000. And the bosses give in and are quite taken aback by this actually very quickly. And this is going on. Unfortunately, the others weren't that straightforward. This is going on actually at the same time as the Second International is meeting. And the most significant thing to come out of the Second International is the call to make May Day an international day of action for the demand of the 8-hour day. And one of the most Eleanor's most significant achievements is organising the 8-hour demonstration in Hyde Park in London that brings together anywhere between a quarter to half a million workers. So this is, you know, she speaks as a trade unionist and a socialist, at this demonstration. And it's out of this that it sparks strikes in a whole series of industries for the 8-hour day. Some are won, others are not. The new unionist movement, that was born at this time, unfortunately evaporates quite quickly, and it's out of the defeats actually that the move towards the Labour Party is built. And I'll leave that perhaps for the discussion, but it is worth saying that the significance of the new unionist movement was to challenge the very conservative outlook of the old trade unionist movement that had been confined to the ranks of skilled workers, had actually been very, very elitist towards the unskilled, and let alone to women and the Irish. And it also challenged their conciliation approach with the bosses, and obviously in favour of an open sort of class struggle approach. Secondly, it was born, as I hope, you know, people would get a sense of by now, it was born amongst those that were considered the hardest to organise: the young, the unskilled, immigrant labour, and women. Now, Eleanor, even from this, you can get a sense of her practical commitment to organising amongst the oppressed, but this went alongside a theoretical understanding of oppression as well. And she writes in 1886 a very important pamphlet about women's oppression, just off the back of Engels' path-breaking work, The Family, Private Property and the State, and Auguste Babel's pamphlet, The Woman Question. So this is a time when the socialist movement is trying to come to grips with the origins of women's oppression. And Eleanor, you know, adds to that by writing this pamphlet, actually with Aveling, I might add as well, that that women's oppression must be understood as being rooted in the economic organisation of society. She talks about marriage as being an economic relationship. She talks about the double shift that women have to endure, because remember, at this point, women are not just in the homes, women are workers as well. So she talks about the double shift that they have to bear, much like, of course, we talk about today. She also talks about the double standards. So she describes women's oppression in her time, comes up with or adds to the theory of where it comes from, but she also polemicises against the bourgeois feminists. She talks about, you know, those that advocate just women's rights as having nothing to say to a working class audience. And in fact, she attends a suffrage meeting where she argues for the vote to be given to working class women, and actually that's defeated at the conference, because bourgeois women only wanted working class women to be exploited equally with their male counterparts. I'll finish up now by making a few concluding points. I think that one of her strengths was her versatility, to be able to adapt to the changing needs of the struggle at the time. It saw her play a very, very practical role as a translator, as an organiser, but also a more prominent role as a writer and a very, very popular speaker. To give you a sense of her popularity, when she was most active during, you know, that period of 1889 to 1891, she had to take out an ad in the trade union and the socialist press asking people to please refrain from putting her name on advertising that she was speaking somewhere before she'd actually been asked, because she found herself committed to speak in several different locations at the one time, but it was because her name brought record crowds to hear her speak. What I want to argue, you know, few of her contemporaries, as I went through, few of her contemporaries were able to stay the course, were able to adapt and play a role in the same way that Eleanor did. And what I want to argue is that this is for two reasons. One was that she saw herself as the torchbearer of her father's ideas, and secondly, it was her strong identification with the working class and with their struggles that impelled her to where to go, wherever they were organising. And indeed, this was able to see her maintain her commitment to the struggle of socialism through workers' own actions. And it's this tradition that we too use as our guide as we go to build a socialist organisation that also wants to intervene in the struggles around us today. I'll leave it there.